You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
I am just going to invite my colleague to tell us about the upcoming interesting conversation that we're going to have. It is my pleasure to introduce you to Lisa. Lisa, tell us what's happening
today. Thank you so much.
Over to you, Lisa.
Why don't we just give a round of applause for our wonderful host, Batanai. Great job. Incredibly enthusiastic. I hope you guys are good. As he said, my name is Dr. Lisa Ajay. I'm one of the British Church Relationship Managers for Christian Aid. And you're so welcome to this stage, to the no-fly zone. And we have a really exciting conversation today. And so in this no-fly zone, you're also part of history. This is the first time that Greenbelt has done this. Give it up for Greenbelt. This is a phenomenal idea. You know, instead of flying in people from all around the world, we're going to be joined live stream by people from all over. And today we've been joined by people from Uganda, from Kenya, from Australia, from the United States, from South Africa. Whoa, what country was that? South Africa. And today on the panel, we're going to be joined by a guest from the Dominican Republic as well. And so really amazing initiative that they've taken to rethink the models around how we engage with voices from the global majority. And you'll know at this stage, all throughout the time here at Greenbelt, we're going to be dealing with a lot of different justice issues, racial justice, economic justice, climate justice. And today the conversation is around reparations. And you know, you heard earlier on today, if you're around at 12:30 or 12 o'clock-ish, we had a conversation around no white saviorism, which was an amazing conversation. And the engagement from so many of you listening in and asking questions. And then we've had a film called After the Flood and a panel with Professor Robert Beckford and Claire Williams, phenomenal theologians engaging in the content of that film, looking at the church's involvement in transatlantic slavery. And so now we're going to be talking about reparations. What do we do with that legacy of slavery? And I want to encourage us here today that there may be points in this conversation that are uncomfortable. And I'm just going to name it. And I want to encourage us to lean into the discomfort, to embrace the discomfort. That there might be moments where you might think, oh, this is getting close to home. Good. We want it to get close to home. We don't want to hold back. This is a really important conversation for us to have. You know, the president of Barbados said, the conspiracy of silence has diminished the horror of what our people has faced. And today we don't want silence. We want to be loud and engage the conversation and lean in. And so I want to encourage you to do that. So earlier this year, I joined a pilgrimage of church leaders from the UK, from the Church of Scotland, the United Reformed Church and the Scottish Episcopal Church on a pilgrimage to Jamaica. And our one theme was to look at the legacies of slavery, both past and current, that are still present in the land, and to look at the theme of reparations and what that meant for those church denominations. And so this session is going to explore some of that. It's going to explore some of the journey. It's going to explore some of the connection between our faith and reparations. And we're joined by three great speakers. And so the first up, we've got lecturer and broadcaster, Professor Robert Beckford. Why don't we just give a round of applause to him and the phenomenal work he's doing around the UK. We've also joined by the former moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland, the Right Reverend Sally Foster Fulton, and the amazing woman that she is, phenomenal leader. And she also took part in the pilgrimage to Jamaica. And on screen, you can see on screen, we're joined by one of our partners, Mr. Dario Solano, who works for one of our Christian Aid partners, Red Afros, advocating for African descent people across Latin America and the Caribbean. So Dario, welcome. It's an honor to have you with us from the Dominican Republic. And Dario is Spanish speaking. And so again, in this conversation, we want to practice what we're talking about, that we're not centering the language of English. And so he's going to be speaking to us in Spanish, and there's a translator that will be translating for us. And so I want to encourage you, don't tap out when he's speaking. Don't disengage or lean back. This is really important for our journey as well, that we make space and we honor the voices of people if their language is not English. And so I want to give grace for us to have time and pauses and to be okay with that on this journey. So are you ready to go? Yeah? Good. All right. So first up, Sally, I'm going to come to you first. So you were part of this pilgrimage with me on behalf of the Church of Scotland, looking at the legacy of slavery. And I want to ask you, can you tell us something about your own experience and what you think the church in the UK should be doing next?
So it was a pilgrimage with three denominations in Scotland, the Scottish Episcopal Church, the United Reformed Church, and the Church of Scotland. And we're all in very different spaces, but wanted to find ways that we could work together. And early on in last summer, we met with the Church's Reparation Action Forum from Jamaica, wonderful group of church leaders from across denominations in Jamaica who've come up with a 7-point plan. They've identified 7 issues that they trace back to that legacy of slavery, and they've come up with 7 solutions, not a silver bullet, but solutions to those issues, and they want to implement them, and they're looking for people to come on that journey. So we went there together. I think for me, several things leapt out. Now, I'm not originally from the United Kingdom. In fact, I'm from South Carolina, so lower state South Carolina. And some of the things that really resonated with what's happening in the UK and what happens in the States, and one of the things that Kraft is working on is reclaiming that history and being honest about that history. And as you said, it can be painful sometimes. But one of the things that I know growing up in South Carolina is we learned a whole lot about emancipation. We learned a whole lot about the end of slavery, but we didn't connect those dots about who was enslaving in the first place and how this happened and how it was continuing to happen. And in regards to our churches, having that very honest conversation with each other and with ourselves about the impact and the legacy that we have, the participation that we had in chattel slavery. Now, again, we talk in the Church of Scotland an awful lot about, you know, emancipation and how we were part of that abolitionist movement, but over 20,000 people from Scotland emigrated to the West Indies and participated in that chattel slavery and in those plantations. So much of the economics in the UK and in Scotland was built on the back of the slave trade. A lot of the money when slavery was abolished and people were compensated. And by the way, one of the things that blew my mind is families of enslaving families were being compensated up until 2015. This is still happening. This is still happening. We're paying compensation to families of people who had to give up their slaves, and we're having the conversation about reparations and being quite uptight about that. But where are our churches? How do we retell our own history? How do we claim that and learn? And how do we also repent and embrace the idea of repentance, that turning around and doing something a different way? But you have to acknowledge you were going in the wrong way in the first place. You have to acknowledge that you're still walking in the wrong way in so many instances, and that racism and that legacy of slavery is still very much alive with us and causing so much damage. And one of the other things I think we need to do as denominations and as communities, and Christian Aid is not exempt from this, and I think that's something we have discussed a lot, is let's be very careful that we do not reinvent by default the same kind of processes that caused this in the first place, that extractive model. And we saw one firsthand in Jamaica. I was absolutely astounded to know that the UK government have an active recruiting process for the teachers in Jamaica. Education is one of the big issues that the Church's Reparation Action Forum are working on. We have an active recruitment policy. We go in and take the best teachers from Jamaica. And by the way, they can't bring their families here. That sounds very colonial to me. That sounds very extractive. It resonates. It resonates with slavery. So those were just some of my initial
thoughts. Wow, very, very powerful. Thank you so much, Sally. Mm. Thank you. Yeah. You can clap, yeah. Professor Robert, I'm going to come to you next. And I just want to honour you because you have had You've been in this space for a very long time, and I want to honor your heart for staying in this and speaking up on this. And you've been an advocate for church reparations for a long time, but you've also been very publicly critical of the steps that have been taken so far, specifically by the Church of England and others. And we want to ask you why. You know, what do you see that's going wrong?
Yeah, thank you for the contribution. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Look, I would say this, and I'll try and make it as succinct as possible, and looking at three categories. First, I would say what's taking place amongst the churches at the moment is not reparations. It's at best perpetrator reparations. Mm. And when the perpetrators set the sentence, you know they're going to give it as short as possible. That's what when you go to court, I don't go too often. When you go to court, the judge determines the sentence. There's an adjudicator, there's some mediation, not the person who's committed the crime. So what we've got at the moment is where the perpetrators are determining the nature of the recompense and the restitution. That's not how you do reparations. Reparations isn't perpetrator-led, it's victim-led. Mm-hmm. So if you think of reparations, first etymologically, in terms of repairing, that's its root, it's about repairing. How that's been explored in law is through compensation metrics as a feature of reparations, but not just compensation. It's also about, restitution. Giving people, restoring people to where they were, satisfaction, which is really about truth and reconciliation commissions, ensuring that there's non-reoccurrence of what's actually taking place before, ensuring that there's rehabilitation of people so they can get back to where they were before. There are at least five clear themes that are involved in traditional legal forms of reparations. None of that's being catered for within any of the discourses that are taking place at the moment within the Church of England. That's deeply problematic. It's not reparations. Even if you use some of the language that they're now using, where they talk about reparatory justice. When I heard the church talking about something, my goodness, reparatory justice is really quite radical, because reparatory justice takes the five key themes from reparations and asks for more.
Yeah.
It says, first of all, we want an apology. And at the end of it, we want some form of reconciliation. And that reconciliation has to also involve non-reoccurrence, which means you have to deal with the structures and systems that cause the problems in the present. It's asking for much more. So when I heard the church talking about reparatory justice, I thought, my goodness, these people are more radical than Malcolm X. And then when I actually looked at what was taking place, it's perpetrator reparations. How does perpetrator reparations work? Two stages. You give an apology, and then you determine the amount that you're going to pay. You control the discourse. And when you control the discourse and you control the money, Foucault would say, you control the people. Mm. So what's happening at the moment is pseudo reparations. How can you restore it? Yes, you can turn it around. Just use the traditions of restorative justice. You start with the truth telling.
Yeah.
Mm. Tell people what took place in the killing fields of the plantations and how they continue to impact church life here in Britain. Just look at, Pentecostal, you see, we have no conception of time, I'm sorry. I'm institutionalized by my church. But if you look at, just look at theological education. The last 100 years, three books written by theologians racialized as white addressing this issue. In the same demographic, in the same period, over 50 books written on being nice to animals. We have not addressed this issue at all. In fact, animal theology has greater output than people dealing with the church's 500-year sojourn with racial terror within the Caribbean. Truth tell, truth seek, truth tell, and then we can have a proper discussion about how we go forward. Mm-hmm. And that's where we can begin working through those categories of restoration and healing that we find within reparation, and then we can talk about the nature of the reconciliation after. So there's a structure. Not one of the churches involved in this process has bothered with that structure. Mm. It's problematic. Mm. So they're not doing reparations. Mm. This is perpetrator justice. Mm. Perpetrator justice is Al Capone.
Wow. Mic drop moment. Thank you so much, Professor Robert Beckford, for that. And a good challenge. And I hope that, you know, we're taking notes. I hope we're leaning into the conversation. Dario, I'm going to come to you. And I want to ask you, you know, you're very involved in campaigning for reparations, both in the Dominican Republic and globally. How can we understand this issue of church reparations in the context of the need for reparations globally? I hope that's come through clearly.
Sí, claro. Muchísimas gracias. Para mí una gran satisfacción.
Thank you very much. For me, it's a pleasure and a privilege to be here and share the stage with you.
Y a la vez poder estar en una audiencia con la que podemos compartir algunas.
And to be in front of an audience with which we can share some of our concerns and certain commitments.
Frente a esta pregunta, yo pienso que la mejor forma
in regards to your question, I think the best way is to immediately acknowledge that when we talk about reparation, we are addressing one of the most horrendous things that have happened to humanity, and that is currently known as a crime against humanity.
Y que justamente todavía en nuestro pueblo están vigentes las consecuencias de lo que fue aquel
consequences of such heinous crime still alive in our people.
Y que hoy en día el proceso de reparación
the reparation process goes beyond the fight against discrimination and racism.
Y que tiene que abrirse a una posibilidad.
It needs to open the doors to acknowledging that there were many actors involved in this crime against humanity, including political powers as well as religious powers. In Latin America and the Caribbean, there's about 200 million human beings that recognize ourselves as Afro-descendants. Let's bear in mind that Latin America and the Caribbean is one of the most unequal areas in the world.
However,
the face of poverty and exclusion has the same face as people of African descent.
Entonces, en esta perspectiva, el liderazgo de la iglesia por lo que fue ese compromiso y esa alianza que estableció con el poder es fundamental.
As a result of its alliance with the power, is key.
Pero también este proceso tiene algunos, el proceso de la reparación tiene
algunos. The process of reparation has certain requirements.
Tenemos que ver que las víctimas estén identificadas.
We need to identify the victims.
Plenamente identificadas.
Have them fully identified.
Que los hechos estén plenamente también documentados.
We also need to fully have a full documentation of the events.
Es como tomar en cuenta lo que decía el profesor. Tenemos que hacer.
As the professor was saying, we need to take a truth-centered approach.
Porque todavía nuestro texto han sido trabajados
because
por los colonizadores.
Our text. Our texts, existing texts, were worked or drafted by colonizers.
Entonces, en este otro nivel de requisito es como la conexión, el
vínculo de ese pasado con el presente. The connection between the past and the present, the current situations.
Pero también la reparación tiene dimensiones.
Reparation also has certain dimensions.
Una dimensión política, una
a political dimension, a psychological dimension. An educational dimension, economic dimension,
social,
social dimension,
cultural,
a cultural dimension.
Pero hay que tomar medidas para este proceso de reparación.
And we need to take measures for this process, which needs to be made consciously.
Y no se trata de quedarnos en el dolor, en el daño.
It's not just about focusing on the pain and the harm done. We need to project ourselves towards building more equal societies.
Y esa reparación, esas modalidades tienen que darse en la reparación.
And those reparations need to consider material reparation, spiritual reparation,
y en la reparación moral.
And moral reparation.
El perdón tiene que ser formal y tiene
forgiveness
que ser
needs to be formal and conscious.
En esa perspectiva, entiendo que el escenario teológico,
from that perspective, I understand that from the theological standpoint, churches do have a certain authority
de realizar una nueva conversión en el sentido de entender la dimensión del
to
pecado,
promote a new conversion in understanding the sin against those commitments, as well as how they were accomplices to those heinous events.
Entonces, necesitamos justamente
thus,
que sea un movimiento en crecimiento
fact,
para poder enfrentar
this to be a growing movement to tackle resistance.
Y no se trata de rehacer la victimización.
It's not just a matter of revisiting victimization of what Africa was and people of African descent.
Sino que para lograr la convivencia pacífica y la paz necesariamente tiene que haber
in order to have peace, we need to have reconciliation.
Y la reconciliación tiene que ser a partir del conocimiento de la verdad.
Reconciliation starts from acknowledging the truth.
Eso entiendo, es el gran desafío que tenemos.
That's our greatest challenge.
Wow. Dario, thank you so much. And I don't know if you can hear it, but this theme of truth-telling is coming through so loudly. And I'm reminded of the African proverb that until the lion speaks, the hunter looks like the hero. Mm. And there's this powerful opportunity that we have to listen to the stories being told by the communities themselves, by us, by our own people, of the realities of the slave trade and its long-lasting legacies. This is incredibly important on the journey. We have to name and face what has happened. Sally, I'm going to come back to you and ask you about, because you touched on Scottish history, and I'm going to ask you about what can the church do in that education, in telling the truth around history, telling the other side of the story, the truth to what's happened.
Two or three things come into my mind. One goes straight to that truth telling, and it's hard to even say, but I think we have to grapple deeply with how embedded racism is, how deeply embedded that white superiority complex is in our lives, and address it and call it out, whether we're looking out at others or we're looking in the mirror, which is sometimes even harder. That's a start. It's a very personal one. In regards to things that denominations can do, and that's one of the things that we are looking at in Scotland with the Scottish Episcopal Church, the URC, the Church of Scotland, and hopefully the Quakers who have been on board, is how do we go back and reclaim that history and tell it authentically? What do we do with our buildings, with memorials to enslavers? How do we retell that story and say, you know, actually, and sometimes that means cede the space, get out of the way, and let people with lived experience tell the stories and stop sanitizing it? I know when we were in Jamaica, a couple of things just really, I think, shook me. One was in a primary school, a rural primary school, and we met with the teachers, and one of the teachers said, you know, I have been robbed of my identity. She said, I don't know who I am. I don't know where I came from. My surname is Campbell. Do you really think so? You can't pay that back. But what you can do is say, that is wrong, and for the part that I am still playing in this, help us turn around. We need to turn around. We can do that. We can do that. I also agree with Robert. We have to get really serious about how we address this. Now, I know the Church of Scotland is working on writing a formal apology. That has to be step one. And we have to have a path to say what is next. And it has to be led, not by us, but by the people we are learning from our friends and colleagues that we are learning from about what this looks like, feels like, and continues to feel like.
Great. Thank you so much, Sally. Thank you. Professor Robert, I'm going to come to you next. And you talked about reparations and what people need to do. I wonder if there are any examples of reparations that we can look to. If someone was here in the audience and saying, is there a glimpse of someone who is doing this right or on this journey that we can watch, we can look from, we can learn from? Do you have any examples?
No, there aren't many good examples. It's a relatively new movement. There are projects across the United States that are taking place that are quite interesting. I mean, two I'd highlight Chase Manhattan Bank, for example, they recognized that they held slaves as collateral on loans. During American slavery, they did a basic calculation, didn't do the maths, as the Americans would say, the maths ain't mathing, but they gave money to an African-American educational fund, and that kind of practice has taken place across North America. Virginia Theological Seminary has come up with $1.7 million that they're using to engage diaspora, not diaspora communities, engage the families of African Americans who worked at the college for a pittance for over an extended period of time. So they're giving back to those families in forms of tuition, opportunity to study at the seminary, use the seminary. That's one example. Out in California, the governor of California currently has on his desk a project based on restituting African-Americans post-slavery who were denied opportunity to buy land, buildings, had land stolen, had businesses destroyed after 1860 in California. And they are planning to give back as a inheritance, is what they're calling it, to the African-American families who qualify, because qualification is very important, $900,000. Each, to each family as a form of inheritance. So those are the projects that are taking place. But what I would say is this, it's not so much about where you end up, it's the process. And that's what matters for Christian people, it's the process. We are called to be, we have a gospel of reconciliation. So therefore we should be taking the lead on this, not allowing other people to determine how the process takes place. And that's why I think it's very important that we work with set categories of reconciliation, the truth seeking, the truth telling, the kind of reconciliation that needs to take place, and restitution being a part of that, and then thinking about what reconciliation looks like at the end of it, but doing this from the bottom up. And that's been the problem. The problem is that the voices of the descendants of victims have been suppressed. And we know that it's been suppressed because if you type into your Google search now, reparations and Britain, all white people turn up. Who were the first people to receive awards for their work in reparations in Britain? It wasn't people like Esther Stanford, campaigned for 30 years, started with Bernie Grant back in 1993 when they set up ARM, African Reparations Movement, with God bless him, former MP for Tottenham, best football team in the world, Bernie Grant. Started with him, campaigned, knocked on all African People's Revolutionary Party for 30 years, knocked on doors, raised money for African Liberation Day to keep the message of reparations alive. All those voices, as black women, have been doing that work, have been suppressed. Who received the first award? The Archbishop of Canterbury. Went out to Jamaica 2 weeks ago. They gave him an award for the work he'd done for reparations. Been on the scene for 2 years. Done perpetrator reparations, the Jamaican University of West Indies, shame on them, gave him an award. Bristol University, 2 days later, Laura Trevelyan gave her an award for her journalism, didn't know much about that, but they gave it also for her work on reparations. What did she do? She went to Grenada, gave an apology, gave them £100,000. Maths ain't mathing. No process. So what I'm saying is, it isn't what people are doing. We've got to work out a Christian process that we can all agree on that will get us to the place of reconciliation. If we do not, we'll be back at this place year after year saying the same thing because we haven't done the hard work of repentance. At the moment, we've got cheap grace. We need some costly grace.
Yeah. Wow. At the moment, we have cheap grace. We need some costly grace. I'm just going to let that resonate out here for a moment. Thank you so much, Professor Robert. I'm going to come to you, Dario, and you touched on the alliance of the church with power. And I think that this is this conversation of, you can't talk about reparations without talking about power and the shift of power and the movement of power. Can you talk to us a little bit about that, the alliance of church and power?
Y el poder.
Sí, bueno, esto es una pregunta bien desafiante, porque lo que se trata
es a very challenging question.
La empresa colonizadora constituyó una alianza.
Colonizing enterprises established an alliance between the church and colonialist countries with that powerful Europe.
Y esa alianza se manifestó
And that alliance became evident in the legitimation of such heinous crimes.
Por eso en este momento, al mismo tiempo que
That's why
al poder, hay que
today
también a las iglesias.
We need to hold power accountable as well as churches.
Si un primer momento estuvo la iglesia católica,
if at first the Catholic Church was involved, after the Catholic Church, Protestant churches became involved.
Entonces, en este momento, esa necesidad de interpelar lo que
thus,
fue ese proceso de
need
poder que fue
call to
por,
accountability
por la religión, por las iglesias,
that process.
Es fundamental establecer algunos niveles
and we need to establish certain levels of accountability among churches.
Y esas responsabilidades justamente tienen que manifestarse desde la perspectiva
and that accountability
del perdón.
Needs to take the shape of asking for forgiveness.
Como base fundamental de un acercamiento a la verdad.
As the main grounds to approach the truth.
Nosotros estamos hablando de la restitución de derechos.
We're talking about reestablishing rights.
Pero no nos podemos quedar solamente analizando
el pasado.
But we can't
just remain analyzing the past.
Hay que ver la consecuencia, lo que
we need to look at the consequences, what we are going through today.
Hay un racismo estructural.
There's a racial, structural racism.
Que se manifiesta tanto en el poder político como en el poder eclesiástico.
That shows both in political power as well as in ecclesiastical power.
Entonces tenemos que ver esa perspectiva
we
que dentro del marco de esa reparación tiene que haber una reparación moral.
We need moral reparation. We need spiritual reparation.
Y otra cosa que tenemos que tener bien claro.
And there's
claro.
Something else that we need to be very clear about.
Cuidado con las falsas soluciones.
Be careful with false solutions.
Pueden venir falsas reparaciones.
We could have false reparations.
Este es un proceso que tiene que darse de manera consciente.
This is a process that needs to be conscious.
Desde la perspectiva de una creación de una ciudadanía crítica.
From the perspective of creating a critical citizenship.
Pero también de una nueva relectura bíblica y teológica para analizar el pasado y el presente.
To reread the Bible and theological issues to analyze the past and the present.
Y me gustó bastante la expresión del león
I really liked
y el cazador.
The saying, the expression about the lion and the hunter.
Porque también hay un adagio africano que dice
because
que el
there's another saying that says colonizer kills twice.
Y la segunda es con la memoria.
And the second time they do it is through memory.
En este momento están apostando de que olvidemos todo ese pasado.
They currently putting all the strength on us forgetting about it.
Para que no seamos capaces de interpelar
sending
este presente
it into oblivion,
y proyectar el futuro.
So we lose our possibilities and power to hold them accountable for the past and the future.
En ese sentido pienso que la iglesia tiene que establecer
thus,
una diferenciación de ese poder político
needs to
y que colonial
draw the line
que hoy se expresa dentro del marco de una perspectiva
power
neoliberal.
That today expresses itself as a neoliberal trend of power.
Está pasando un fenómeno en Europa y en toda
we're
América
seeing
Latina.
A phenomenon in Europe and throughout Latin America.
Como sectores conservadores cada día más tienen poderes.
Conservative sectors have increasing amounts of power.
Al interior de las iglesias y al interior del poder
within
político.
The churches and within the political powers.
Entonces, justamente es mirar hacia adentro para
so
poder
it's a matter of
limpiar la casa.
Inwards to clean our house first.
Y esta reparación tiene que tener una perspectiva de justicia en todos
this
los niveles.
Reparation needs to have a justice perspective at all levels.
Incluso interactuar otra perspectiva de justicia como es
and interacting with other justice perspective including climate and environmental justice.
O sea, de cómo ver también de cómo hoy en día el problema de la exclusión toma matices
understanding that exclusion has different hues with Afro-descendant people.
Eso creo que es parte de los grandes desafíos que tenemos que realizar.
That's what I believe are the most significant challenges and what we need to do right now.
Y que la reparación no es simplemente de la perspectiva económica.
Reparation
reitero.
Doesn't only come from the economic perspective. I repeat.
Gracias.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dario. and what you're sharing with us, just to let you know, I know you can't see us all, but it really is resonating with us who are here. So I'm going to open the floor for questions. If you have questions for any of our speakers and guests, please do raise your hand. Both Batanai and Lydia will have roaming mics, and we will be able to take your questions with us. Just bear with us while they get the mics. But just to keep us thinking about the themes that are coming through, this theme of truth telling is coming through loud and clear, but also this warning around false reparations, pseudo reparations, this form of reparations that looks great, but actually isn't reparative in any way. And so I want us to hold those two things as we continue our conversation today. Thank you, Bat and I. Yeah, go for it.
Thank you very much. Professor Beckford, you spoke very powerfully about the idea of pseudo reparation, and I agree wholeheartedly, but would you not say that part of the problem is a pseudo apology and a pseudo guilt? It's not personal, it's not personally based, it's collective, it's institutional. And it just strikes me that we need to refocus the whole idea, the debate around forgiveness, and simply focus on reparation. If full reparation were made, then wouldn't forgiveness and reconciliation simply follow?
Yeah. Look, I think it's a great question, and I would agree with everything that you said. The only caveat I would add is that you have a thorough theological analysis of forgiveness, because forgiveness is conditional. And the reason I mention that is because in the South African project, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Desmond Tutu went around telling everybody to forgive no matter what. Big problem. It's not biblical. He said forgive them no matter what. 70 times 7. That's not what Jesus meant by that. It's not what New Testament theology means in terms of forgiveness. As a consequence, Truth and Reconciliation collapsed. It didn't work out. The Africans didn't get to deal with the consequences of apartheid in South Africa. So the only thing I would say is, yes, forgiveness should be a part of it, but a proper theological understanding of forgiveness, which is important. If you go back to the Archbishop of Canterbury's speech in Jamaica a few weeks ago, he reduces slavery, a crime against humanity, racial terrorism, racial capitalism, all that went along with that, he reduced it to sin. And I think that's kind of interesting, because actually you don't have to pay anything for sin. You have to pay if it's a legal category. You actually have to do something quite substantial about it. By reducing a crime against humanity to sin, actually in some cases, and I think in this case, is a way of sidestepping the full implications of what took place. So, you know, yes, there's some serious thinking to be done around it. But just to say, people are doing thinking around it. In fact, the Rastafarians, I've been doing thinking around it for about 75, 80 years. So there's a tradition of people thinking about what repair and what restitution looks like. And we should also add, people of the African diaspora have been doing self-repair. It's part of our cultural tradition, part of our identity politics, part of our communal life has been about repairing. So reparations in some respects is just an extension of the self and communal repair traditions that we've been working on since 1492, and Christopher Combust Us ended up in the Caribbean. That's meant to be a pun on Columbus, you know. I didn't really mispronounce it, you know. That's what they call him in the reggae records, Christopher Combust Us.
Thank you so much, Professor, and thank you for that question. Do we have any others? Yes. Go for it, Lydia.
Sorry, just to take a bit of issue with what the last person said, some people got really rich off slavery, and rich people have a lot more say in our society now than poor people. And the people who got rich off slavery, lots of them are still in big positions of influence. I think some of it is personal. As far as I know, my family are a bunch of peasants from I know not where. They didn't buy and sell people. They probably were too busy scratching a living and being prostitutes, which is, as far as we can tell, how most of my female ancestors made a living. But the people who did voting Richard Drax. He's still in the Houses of Parliament. He's still got a plantation. There's lots of people who are still benefiting from trafficking in people. And I think we should be looking to set them down or take away some of that power and give it to people who, whilst who are less implicated by it, who are less happy to live off the profits of human trafficking and exploitation and genocide. Sorry.
No, I agree.
I agree. I've always had a real issue with the word privilege. We bandy it about quite the thing when privilege, if you strip it away, is very often, if not always, power that does not belong to you. And whether you've taken it intentionally or it's fallen into your hands, it's not yours. And so handing it back to the person it belongs to is a first start. So I hear where you're coming from in that space about the personal. I also think, though, as civic society, as communities, we need to really hold on to and understand that the Industrial Revolution was fueled and financed by the slave trade, and all of us benefited from that, except the people who were enslaved. So we've got to hang on to those levels of where the injustice sits and where the reparations need to come from.
Yeah. Thank you, Sally. Any others?
I mean, I would just throw something else in about the kind of proletariat dimension to this. I'd agree completely that we all, that Britain benefited as a whole from colonialism, transatlantic chattel slavery. The benefits go throughout the whole of the society. There's a lot of documented evidence that, on this now in terms of how much Britain benefited. But in terms of thinking about proletariat struggle, there are some really interesting narratives that emerge from slave history about collaborations amongst proletarian whites and enslaved Africans to revolt against the forms of capitalist exploitation that we're experiencing. Read Marcus Rediker's book on the slave ships, for example, and how at the beginning of slavery, poor whites have been commandeered, literally ripped off the streets to do the bidding of rich white people in terms of the brutalizing, the factory. The word factory emerges out of this culture, literally creating enslaved people from Africans. By the end of the 18th century, they're saying, we're not doing this anymore. Those are the poor white people who are saying, we're not doing this. The work of Michael Eric Dyson, The Multi-Headed Hydra, which is a collection of stories of common revolt amongst proletariat whites and enslaved blacks across the Americas to revolt against capitalism, new forms of capital they're experiencing. So there is another narrative, and that's why the storytelling, the truth-seeking, is important. There's lots of dimensions to this. It's really quite nuanced. Equally, we have to acknowledge the ways in which African countries were complicit. African nations in particular, not countries, ethnic groups. Look, by the end of slavery, the Ashanti, had 10,000, sorry, by the abolition of the transatlantic slave trade in 1807, had 100,000 men in arms. Most of them were guns from Birmingham, which were a bad bargain, because we know only one in five of them actually worked. But the Ashanti were willing to work against other ethnic groups in order to keep the trade going. You know, so we've got to deal with the nuances and the complexities and acknowledge the multidimensional nature of this history is very important.
Yeah.
So I'm not knocking all Ghanaians there.
No. But even in that Ashanti history, there's also part of that narrative is that a lot of them were under duress, you know, and so it was either sell or be sold. Yeah. And so, you know, in the complexity of that. And so what we're hearing is there's a lot of nuance and a lot of history that has to be told. We can't settle for easy answers. We must dig and retell those stories. Yeah. Baton Isa, question at the back. Oh, you've got a microphone already. Go for it, sir.
So the Church of England has come up with what has been described this afternoon as perpetrator reparations. And the committee, I believe, working on it, doubled the amount they said should be there. What is your recommendation as to how to respond to that, as in just go away and start again? Because it seems to me that the reaction against it has been the reaction to pay any reparations at all.
Do you want to take that, Robert?
Sure. Look, I think the Anglican project is quite complex, and I would argue that the rot sets in much earlier, because if you look at their own website in terms of the paper trail, they acknowledge in 2019 that there's an issue here. You know, they get to it quite late, because we've been talking about it for, what, 100 years? About the Codrington estate and everything else. But then they write the report. The report is fundamentally about the Queen Anne's bounty, not necessarily about the Codrington estate, when every Archbishop of Canterbury was a chair for the Society of Propagation of the Gospel. So they didn't want to engage in that history. So the historiography was problematic from the start. Once they'd commissioned the report, they invited in two advisors to help them think about where they should go. Who are these two advisors? The two Ghanaians. Now, transatlantic chat was about the West Indies, fundamentally, in terms of the Anglicans. But they invited in two Ghanaians who were detached from this history to advise them on what to do next. I think that's hugely problematic. Then they came up with the idea of having this repair, not even repair, it's called an investment fund, they're calling it now. It doesn't even have the word reparations in it or repair. It's all problematic. I mean, they could have got free advice at the bookie shop around the corner from my house. These guys are more schooled in terms of how to do reparatory justice than what actually happened. So the rot set in way back. And then they set up, they appointed two people racialized as white to then run the whole thing. Appointed. Then these two appointed people said that all the black people who wanted to be on the advisory board had to apply. So they're asking people who are experts in this field. They said, we're not, but you've got to apply. We were just appointed. So for me, the whole construction was highly institutional, hierarchical, and therefore could only produce something that was problematic. So it's no surprise, therefore, that you end up with an advisory group who are saying it wasn't double. They said, pay what is due. Zacchaeus gives back four times. What is actually due is 1.2 billion. We know you haven't got that kind of money, but we need to do more than the 100 million because the maths ain't mathing. They came up with that figure, plucked it out of the air. You know, so it's problematic in that sense. So what I'm saying is, because the process wasn't proper, wasn't thought through, they didn't even ask advice from the right people as far as I was concerned, it's no wonder they're being attacked from both sides. On the one hand, the Nigel Biggers of this world, who don't believe that the church has anything to apologise for, thinks that mass rape, mass torture, mass racial terror of African people in the West Indies was, to quote him, humane. Getting criticism from that side. We've just found out that there are people now who are not giving their, when they die, they're not giving their money to the Anglican Church because they're worried that it'll go towards reparations. It says a lot about how you've been teaching people over the last 30, 40, 50 years about the history of race and race relations, the church's involvement within it. And then on the left, they've got people like me saying, well, the process doesn't make any sense. So for me, it's inevitable. If you start out with dodgy foundations, how do you think the house is going to look? I say this to the guy building the extension next door all the time. He hasn't got it yet. But obviously, if the foundations aren't right, it's not going to last for long. So I would say what they need to do is completely revise the process. Look at the models that are taken. Read Jarrett Schell's book on what the Episcopalian Church is doing in Washington, a much better model. Read the book by Kwong and Thompson, Reparations for the Churches, which goes through the kind of theological hoops that you have to jump through in order to begin the process of reparations. People have done this work. So if you've got scholars, you've got a history, and people have been doing this kind of campaigning for the last 50, 60, 70 years, why would you avoid them?
Yeah.
You avoid them because you want to control the discourse. You control the discourse, you control the money, you control the people. Which leads me to say that this isn't so much about dealing with issues of sin. It's a Pentecostal. We talk about the demonic. You see, we like the idea of the spiritual world. We're still connected to our African heritage in that way, you know. So for me, the crime here is about occult practice. How the church, through its sojourn with racial terror, corrupted its theology. It became part of an occult, a co-conspirator, to use police language, with the injustice. And therefore, what we need to be thinking about theologically is forms of exorcising. Yeah. How do we cast out the corruption that still remains as a part of our sojourn with this history? So I would say, in a nutshell, what do we expect?
Great. Thank you so much, Professor. Thank you. I'm going to come to you, Dario, because you use the language of crime against humanity. And I want to ask you, how important is language on this journey? Using the right terms, naming the right things as they are. How important is that?
Es el nombre que es. ¿Cuál es su importancia?
Sí, yo pienso que es fundamental de cómo también el mismo lenguaje nos lo impusieron.
That language was imposed on us.
Como parte de un proyecto ideológico de dominación.
As part of an ideological domination project.
Y es por eso que hace un momento mencionaba el concepto del papel y el rol que juega la memoria.
The role that memory plays.
Porque de buena a primera también nos han impuesto un lenguaje
Because
que nos repitiéndolo.
We have been imposed a language and certain words that we have become used to.
Y el lenguaje también nos esclaviza.
And language enslaves also.
Tiene que pasar una revolución a nivel de la memoria.
We need to have a memory revolution.
Porque en este momento también tenemos que asistir a la construcción
Because
de una nueva ética.
Currently we also need to build a new ethics.
Y tenemos que ver una perspectiva que estamos frente a un modelo
We need to understand that we're facing an economic and political model
que es que reproduce e imposibilita
which reproduces
un abordamiento de manera objetivo
and
de lo
hinders
que fue el pasado.
An objective approach of the past.
Porque estamos viviendo un presente
Because
que
we
reproduce
are
esas
living
cadenas del pasado.
A present that reproduces those chains of the past.
Entonces, el lenguaje mismo constituye parte
Therefore,
de un proyecto ideológico.
Language is part of an ideological project.
Hace un momento que hablaba con Andrés.
A few moments ago, when I was talking with Andrés,
mi traductor,
my interpreter,
él me decía que si era lo mismo decir negro que decir afrodescendiente.
Was it the same thing if I said black or afrodescendant?
Yo pienso que mi mejor experiencia que puedo pasar de este encuentro
the
con ustedes.
Best message that I could convey to you.
Es que Andrés a partir de ahora diga afrodescendiente.
Is that Andrés from now on will say people of African descent rather than black people?
Porque los africanos se dieron cuenta que eran negros
Because
cuando
Africans
salieron de África.
Learned that they were black when they were taken away from Africa.
En el 2001, en la tercera
In 2001,
contra el racismo,
during the third world conference against racism in Durban.
Fue que logramos introducir el término afrodescendiente.
We were able to introduce the Afro-descendant term with the United Nations.
Porque éramos definidos a partir de una pirámide
Because we had been defined
europeo,
based on a racial pyramid created by white Europeans.
Entonces necesitábamos una autodefinición desde una perspectiva liberadora.
So there was a need of a self-definition from a liberating and decolonialistic perspective.
Entonces, hoy en día, el lenguaje es fundamental para nuestro
So,
proceso.
Currently, language is fundamental for a liberation process.
Y estamos en un debate que tiene mucha resistencia.
And this is a debate that causes a lot of resistance.
Y mucha falta de voluntades políticas.
And added to a lot, a significant lack of political will.
Y es el gran desafío que también tenemos los afrodescendientes de la
That's
construcción
a huge
de un
challenge of Afro-descendants to build a huge movement with the capacity of mobilize and propose.
Y una cuestión es que tenemos que estar bien claro es
We
que
need to be very clear about something
racismo,
else. The fight against racism and discrimination and xenophobia
no es un papel exclusivo de los afrodescendientes.
It's not an exclusive task of people of African descent.
Es de toda la sociedad en general.
It's an issue of the whole society at large.
Yeah. Es una vergüenza para cualquier democracia que exista
Shame
racismo y discriminación.
On any democracy that still holds racism and democracy. And discrimination.
Todo este movimiento fascista, xenófobo,
It's shameful seeing these xenophobic movements have been growing.
Entonces, el poder de la palabra y del lenguaje es fundamental.
The power of words and language is fundamental.
Y agradezco mucho a Christian Ney y a este
I
escenario.
Thank Christian Aid and for enabling this space. Despite the fact that I'm speaking in Spanish and the need for an interpreter, it's also a way to decolonize language.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, ultimately, I believe that language is of the utmost importance to define our process, to make it understandable. Because we have had problems with access to information.
Entonces, se han creado unos códigos para entramparnos.
There's thus, as a result, there have been codes created to entrap us.
Para continuar con el proceso de opresión.
To force us into this oppression loop.
Por lo tanto, la reparación tiene una implicación de un carácter de una nueva ética.
Therefore, reparation requires this whole new ethics.
Donde el lenguaje tiene que constituirse en un elemento
where language needs to become the element of a new power.
Gracias.
Thank you.
Thank you. Gracias. Thank you so much, Dario. Thank you. Really, really powerful. Thank you so much for that. Powerful words around the power of language. We probably have time for one last question. Anyone want to take that slot?
There was someone at the back before. Do you still want to ask a question? Yeah.
Firstly, I just wanted to say thank you so much. I feel like I've learned a huge amount, and I'm realizing that I severely under and untruthed about this, and so to hear about the truth telling and learning so much, I really, really appreciate it. I kind of wanted to ask, what are the kind of barriers to meaningful reparations? Is it history? Is it money? Is it the rotten institutions? Is it kind of everything? And what are some really kind of fundamental steps that could be taken, that we could collectively take to try and remove those barriers? Because I try and approach things from a place of just kindness. And like, if I have power that's unfair, just give it up. So it confuses me that other people don't do that. So I'd love to get your thoughts, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a great question. What I'm going to do with the time we've got left is maybe ask each of our panelists one barrier and one next step. So something really practical for the people who have gathered here today. You're doing great, guys. Well done. Almost there. One barrier, one next step from each of you. You want to kick us off, Sally?
Ignorance is one barrier. And I'm going to be really greedy and say our love of control is another one.
Mm. Wow.
Just to say, well, I'm going to answer in two ways because I'm a Pentecostal, you see. We don't hear the questions in the same way as everybody else. So I'm going to just say there is some really fantastic work taking place. University of Bristol, for example, is running a reparations assembly, a community assembly, where they're educating people in the communities to understand reparations and reparatory justice.
Great.
One's taking place in Birmingham as well. My hope is that Christian Aid will develop a resource for all church communities to use in terms of how to develop them. There is also a study book that the Churches Together in Britain has produced, Wally Hudson Robson's, called I Will Repay, which is a study guide. There's also a study guide connected to this film as well. So the educating your part, there's resource there to help you with it. But the three the barriers that people face, yes, ignorance. Stuart Hall called it historical amnesia. Mm. That's part of the problem. It's a disease that we have in Britain. We only remember, yes, certain parts of the past. We neglect others. Paul Gilroy then adds another barrier, which is post-colonial melancholia. We respond to it with guilt and with negativity, and as a consequence of that, we don't really address the issues that necessarily need to take place. So those are two really fundamental barriers. The third barrier is this, and I'm going to say this really, really quickly. The third barrier is Christianity. And I see why the third barrier is Christianity, because Christian theology was corrupted by its sojourn with colonialism. Corrupted soteriology, our doctrine of salvation, corrupted our biblical hermeneutics, how we interpret the text, corrupted our understanding of what it means to be human, Christian anthropology. So part of the problem is that we need to do our work over as theologian, that's quoting from W.E.B. Du Bois, said this 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. Do your work over. The maths ain't mathing. The theology ain't theologizing. Start again and decolonize what you have so you can go forward.
Mm. Thank you, Professor. Thank you. And I'm gonna throw that question last to Dario. Any barrier? Next step? What's the next step for someone here? Very quickly.
Yo pienso que hay una barrera fundamental.
I think there's a key barrier. All this mindset and these pre-established ideas.
Donde hay una resistencia a reconocer la dimensión.
Which contain the resistance of acknowledging the dimension of enslavement, colonialism, and transatlantic trade.
Una perspectiva, pienso, es que ya se está generando a nivel de Naciones Unidas.
My point of view is that at the UN level, there are already certain spaces,
como es el Foro Permanente de Afrodescendientes,
such as the Permanent Afrodescendant Forum.
Y que en este momento también hay un borrador para lo que es la declaración
universal de los derechos y la promoción de los derechos declaration
de los afrodescendientes
of the human rights of Afrodescendants.
Y por lo tanto pienso que se está creando un escenario internacional.
And as such, I believe that we're currently enabling an international scenario to understand that Afrodescendants and Africa has the right and the need for reparation from the harm caused in the past. And going back to the obstacle or the barrier, I think the current economic and political models are built on the foundation of extending or perpetuating social inequality, where race plays a key role.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dario. Thank you. We've come to the end of our time in this particular session. I want to say huge thank you to our panelists, Professor Robert Beckford, Right Reverend Sally Foster Fulton, and Mr. Dario Solano. It's been an absolute honor, a real honor. I want to say a huge thank you for the rich conversation we've had, and I'm sure our guests, our UK-based guests, will be around if you do want to catch them afterwards. I'm going to hand back over to our host, Batanai, to tell us what's coming up next.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.